Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. York, this is Democracy Now!
It was the evening of October 1st, 1969, when I first smuggled several hundred pages of top-secret documents out of my safe at the Rand Corporation. The study contained 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. My plan was to Xerox the study and reveal the secret history of the Vietnam War to the American people.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg has died at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His actions helped take down President Nixon, end the war in Vietnam, and lead to a major victory for press freedom. Henry Kissinger once called Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. Today, we honor the life and legacy of Ellsberg in his own words.
If I were asked what regrets I have today, they would have to do with doing a job I was asked to do that I knew was wrong for the country, and I did it to the best of my ability. The war was carried on by people who acted like that.
We'll also look at how Dan Ellsberg became deeply involved in the anti-nuclear movement, which he detailed in his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, and his concerns about Ukraine, China, and more. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we spend the hour remembering the life and legacy of one of the world's most famous whistleblowers, Daniel Ellsberg. He died June 16th at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His family said he died peacefully at home, in no pain, and released a statement that, quote, "Daniel was a seeker of truth and a patriotic truth-teller, an anti-war activist, a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, a dear friend to many, and an inspiration to countless more," unquote. His son, Robert Ellsberg, shared how his father once said he would want his gravestone to say he became a part of the anti-Vietnam and anti-nuclear movement. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, then a top military strategist working for the Rand Corporation, risked life in prison by secretly copying and then leaking 7,000 pages of top-secret documents outlining the secret history of the U.S. war in Vietnam. The leak would end up helping take down President Nixon, help end the war in Vietnam, and lead to a major victory for press freedom. Henry Kissinger once called Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. In 2009, a documentary of the same name told his story.
We are going to win.
Quit making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
Hundreds of thousands we were killing was unjustified homicide, and I couldn't see the difference between that and murder. Murder had to be stopped.
This weekend, portions of a highly classified Pentagon document came to light for all the world to see, brought cries of outrage from Washington.
We gotta get this son of a bitch.
Yes, Kennedy did send in troops in violation of the Geneva Accord. Johnson did start the buildup before he said he was going to. These guys were lying through their teeth when they were talking to us. And here it is in black and white. There's no way of denying it.
The Times building is encircled by armed guards. We are printing tomorrow a top-secret government document.
A name has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon documents. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of these decisions.
Henry Kissinger said that Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
The study was 47 volumes, 7,000 pages.
take me months of Xeroxing.
We've dropped another 200,000 tons of bombs on Indochina. That's 10 Hiroshimas, one Hiroshima a week.
What has remained significant about the release of the Pentagon Papers is the decision by a public official to give priority to conscience as compared to career.
Daniel Ellsberg, whatever his intentions, gave aid and comfort to the enemy.
It was a crime from the start, carried out by four presidents, and now a fifth president was doing the same.
I'm not going to be part of this system of lying anymore.
It wasn't that we were on the wrong side. We were the wrong side.
That's the trailer for The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. It was directed by Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. The Nixon administration went to extraordinary lengths to silence and punish Ellsberg, including breaking into his psychiatrist's office. He was charged with violating the Espionage Act and faced over 100 years in jail. But the government's misconduct led to charges against him and Anthony Russo being dismissed. Ellsberg said he'd been inspired to leak the documents by anti-war protesters. In fact, shortly before the New York Times first reported on the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg took part in an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C. on May Day, 1971, as part of an affinity group with Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. Over the past 50 years, Daniel Ellsberg remained a leading critic of U.S. militarism and U.S. nuclear weapons policy, as well as a prominent advocate for other whistleblowers. He wrote a memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, as well as the 2017 book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Today, we'll feature our interviews with Ellsberg over the years about Vietnam, as well as Ukraine, China, and the threat of nuclear war. We begin with our most recent interview, which was April 27th, when Ellsberg joined us from his home in Kensington, California. He talked about how he went from being a military analyst to a whistleblower and why he risked going to jail in an effort to end the Vietnam War.
Just yesterday was my wife's birthday, and we recalled that it was on April 17th, 1965. Not everyone can remember their first date like that, but that was the first SDS march against the war. And I was working in the Pentagon on the war, pursuing the war. She was going to interview people in a nationwide interview program she had, and she induced me to carry her Ewer heavy phonograph around with her tape recorder to interview people. And I marched up to the White House hoping, carrying that recorder and hoping that I would not be in any picture of the Washington Post, where my colleagues at the Pentagon would say, what? He's protesting the war on my one day off from the war during this. But the next day, I induced her to go to the Cherry Blossoms. And that was our first date. And we've been together ever since. So that was 57 years ago.
She really was the one who exposed you, is this right, to the anti-war movement by forcing you to carry her tape recorder. I mean, you were protesting right outside where you worked. You'd gone from Rand Corporation to the Pentagon.
Actually, it was right outside the Lincoln Memorial where we heard the speeches, and then we marched toward the White House and around the White House. I went back that evening to the Pentagon where I was working, having gotten her to promise to meet me the next day to go see the cherry blossoms. But I was very much in sympathy with what I was hearing on that stadium from I.F. Stone and others about the war. I felt at that time, as a Cold Warrior, that we were picking the wrong place to plant the flag on this one. This was a loser, and I was not enthusiastic about our getting involved in it. But that was my job, and I did it all too well. If I were asked what regrets I have today, they would have to do with doing a job I was asked to do that I knew was wrong for the country, and I did it to the best of my ability. The war was carried on by people who acted like that.
So I want to talk about what you decided to do and how seminal, how key the anti-war movement was to your thinking, not only meeting Patricia, but also seeing those war resistors, what were called draft dodgers, the draft resistors who said they'd rather be in prison than on the front lines in the war in Vietnam.
Well, many people, when the Pentagon Papers came out, a lot of people in the anti-war movement said, what's new about this is what we've been saying all along, which was true, which was that we had taken up a French neocolonial role, an imperial role, essentially, against the self-government of Vietnam, the sovereignty of Vietnam, and were doomed to suffer the same fate as the French, essentially, to keep killing people and losing people until we finally decided to go home and leave them ruling their own home. Well, that was known inside. The insiders who were pursuing the war and dropping the bombs, millions of tons of bombs, it came to be even later than this, knew the same thing and were doing it likewise. The question was what to do about it. All the people I was working with in the government by that time felt, everyone I could think of felt the war was hopeless. Essentially, it was hopelessly stalemated, and there was no coming out. The words hope stalemate was taboo on the year I came back from Vietnam with hepatitis in 1967, after 2 years there. Lyndon Johnson had said no official is to use the word or hint at the word stalemate, and yet that's where it was. So the war continued. People did their jobs, and it went on as though that judgment had not been made. And eventually, what I really noticed was that there were people who felt much as I did and who were doing an awful lot more about it than I was doing. Namely, these were young people who, you didn't have to be an expert. You didn't have to have a PhD in international relations as somebody to see the truth about the war in Vietnam. As somebody said, you don't have to be an ichthyologist to know when a fish stinks. And these young people refused to go to be drafted when they could have gone to Canada or Sweden or gotten a deferment or joined the Air Force National Guard like George W. Bush, somehow gotten out of the fighting. But no, they chose to give it as strong a resistance as they could, nonviolently, in the footsteps of Rosa Parks in the South and Martin Luther King and others, and to say, no, this is wrong. You have to do this over our bodies. We will not participate in this because it's wrong. And I realized when I met young men like this, like Bob Eaton and Randy Keeler, were on their way to prison simply to make the strongest message they could, which I believed as well, that the war was wrong. I realized I could think of doing what they did, too, instead of just talking to insiders who felt as I did, but agreed there was just nothing you could do about it as long as the president wanted to carry on the war and his subordinates wanted to keep their jobs under the president, that they could, in fact, simply dissociate themselves from it and denounce the war openly. Very recently, we've seen very many comments that what the Pentagon Papers showed was that the war was not winnable. Actually, and that's why I gave the Pentagon Papers, and that was the effect of them. Actually, none of the people who went to prison to protest the war did so because they thought the war was not winnable. They did it because they thought the war was wrong. And that's something I think that people have not succeeded, have not been willing to recognize all these years, not just that the war, not just that the U.S. had taken on some noble measure that wasn't quite energetic enough to pursue or had other, or was easily distracted from or something like that, but that our country was, like so many other countries, capable of doing wrong and killing people without good reason. And in effect, an imperial kind of operation like that of the Japanese or the French after the Japanese or the Chinese before either of them. And those were the footsteps we were walking in. Well, I think to this day, the very idea that the U.S. is in some ways comparable to those empires, that it is an empire, is a taboo. And a very unfortunate one because it makes it impossible to understand what's going on. why are we doing this? What's happening? Why in the world are we in this position of ever time after time of fighting against the self-determination or the nationalism of other countries and taking on those murderous tasks as opposed to dealing with problems at home? I think of our country as a covert empire, where covert is a term of art in the Pentagon and the CIA in particular. And I worked with CIA people in Vietnam. My immediate boss there was a retired CIA general, General Edward Lansdale. And the word covert means plausibly deniable. It means not just secret. I'm doing something that I don't tell you about, but that I plant evidence suggests that I'm doing something different. And I'm not doing it. Somebody else is doing it. And the person above me is somebody else. Layer after layer to prevent the president from holding any accountability for what's happening. I think we not only feel we need and do be able to plausibly deny that we are an empire, that we run other people's governments, other people's police forces, that we decide who goes to jail and who gets shot in that country. And second, we deny the means we do to keep it a covert empire: assassinations, paramilitary, military buildups, and even overt wars in some cases, as in Vietnam or Iraq.
Dan, I wanted to go, to that decision you made after giving your 13-year-old son, Robert, a copy of Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. The civil disobedience you engaged in, this is a clip from that 2009 documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Dan Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers.
It was the evening of October 1st, 1969, when I first smuggled several hundred pages of top-secret documents out of my safe at the RAND Corporation. The study contained 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. My plan was to Xerox the study and reveal the secret history of the Vietnam War to the American people.
The FBI was trying to find out who gave the New York Times a copy of the Pentagon's secret study.
Pow, like a thunderclap, you get the New York Times publishing the Pentagon Papers, and the country is panicking.
This is an attack on the whole integrity of government. If whole file cabinets can be stolen and then made available to the press, you can't have orderly government anymore.
A name has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon documents. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I think it is time in this country to quit making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
In the first year of marriage, we're talking about him going to prison for the rest of his life.
Dr. Ellsberg, you have any concern about the possibility of going to prison for this?
We felt so strongly that we were dealing with a national security crisis. Henry Kissinger said that Dr. Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
So that a clip from The Most Dangerous Man in America by Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. I remember when we had you on, Dan, so many different times, beginning 27 years ago, you were one of our first guests on Democracy Now! But when this documentary came out, you and Patricia, your wife, came on the show with the directors. This goes to that point where you understood the stakes of what you were going to do. You brought your two little kids, 13-year-old Robert, 10-year-old Mary, to help you, not that they completely understood what you were doing, Xerox the 7,000 pages of the secret history of Vietnam, U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
That's right. I hadn't really meant to bring my daughter, but on the second occasion at all, she was only 10, but she had complained about being left in the car when I went up to do some last-minute Xeroxing with Robert. And once she was up there, she complained about being given nothing to do. So we gave her scissors, and when, by mistake, the police came to the door for the second time during this project, because the owner of the shop had not turned the key correctly, and it set off an alarm in the police station. So when the police arrived at the door, they found my son, who was 13 at that time, Mike Robert, was running the Xerox machine, and I was collating on the floor various copies we were making, and Mary, who was 10, was cutting Top Secret off the tops and bottoms of the pages with the scissors, kind of a family project, so they saw how innocent it was, and they left. But my objective with my son in particular was to let him see that there were times when the best thing you could do, you really needed to say no to a government policy, even at the risk of prison. And I wanted him to see that I had not gone off my nut, as I would be described shortly, I was sure, that I was not acting as a traitor or fanatically or hysterically. I was just doing something in a business-like way that I felt had to be done, even though it had a risk. I wanted to plant that idea in his life, and it took hold, as it did with my daughter. My son is the editor-in-chief of Orbis Books, the Catholic Seminary Liberation Theology publishing house, and my daughter is head of Violence Against Women Project, a worldwide project at American University, both of them having been arrested at various times. It's,
and you wanted them to know this because you recognized that this could be among the last time you were spending
with them. I would see them. Yes, I thought they'd otherwise just see me through heavy glass in a prison, and would have the way that Julian Assange has had to grow up with his young sons in his total security prison in Belmarsh for having facilitated truth-taking of the same kind that I've done. As a matter of fact, his is the first prosecution of a journalist for putting information out, and it will not be the last if he's successfully extradited over here. So he has a couple of children who've seen him literally only in prison, and better than not seeing him at all. That's certainly the case. But I revealed this year that I had the information from Julian Assange, essentially, that Chelsea Manning had given Assange, and which was later put out in the papers. I had that before the papers, before the newspapers had them, meaning that I was as indictable right now, as I'm talking to you, as any of the people who've been indicted by this Justice Department, because they're working with a law whose plain language is, on the one hand, unconstitutional from the point of view of the First Amendment, but read properly just says that anyone who reads or handles or stores a piece of paper that has been marked to be protected, marked classified by the government, is subject to imprisonment. That implies even to readers of the New York Times, and very definitely to journalists like Charlie Savage or the publishers or Julian himself. In other words, in that respect, we've gone backwards since that day. That was, after all, mine was the first prosecution of anyone for telling the truth to the American people. And there have been several dozen since. And the first one of a journalist, actually, is, I think, just preceding the first one of a reader before we get there. So this law, the Espionage Act, very much needs to be repealed or rescinded in such a way that it does not serve like a British Official Secrets Act, which was a perfect law for an empire.
Dan, even before the Pentagon Papers were published in the Times, but after you had given the secret, the top secret report to the Times, you were trying to end this war any which way. We're broadcasting this show on May Day, on May 1st. And it was May 1st, 1971, that you led a small affinity group that included, Howard Zinn, the late great historian, and Noam Chomsky, to Washington to protest the war. I think Howard would get arrested later that day. But can you talk about that moment, that protest with Howard, Noam, and others?
Well, the idea was that if they won't stop—it was Rennie Davis's idea that if they won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. And so they had about 25,000 people which was not enough, actually, to do it. But we were into affinity groups. And as you say, I was in a very privileged one, privileged for me, with Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and Marilyn Young and Fred, a number of others, Mitch Goodman, Marshall Patachny. And we did, in fact, get beaten over the head on the streets several times and got the advantage of testing, field testing their pepper sprays directly into the face, which is very effective. I'll give a little blurb for it here. It is very disorienting indeed. And then we thought it was pretty much over when they began just clearing the streets of Georgetown by arresting everybody there, including, to their fault, a number of congressmen's children who were shopping in Georgetown. 13,000 people were arrested and put in RFK Stadium without any warrants, without any paperwork as to why they'd been arrested, what they were there. So in the end, they were paid a small indemnity for having done that.
Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers whistleblower, speaking in April. He died June 16th at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. When we come back, we hear from Daniel Ellsberg on Ukraine, on China, the threat of nuclear war, and more.
This country comes from the hearts of men, stood out from the crowd. And the time has come again for good men speaking out. There was a man behind closed doors who shared a secret truth. When he couldn't stand it anymore, he told everything he knew. And the people on the streets of the cities and towns all across this mighty land woke up from a dream when the word came down and began to understand. Telling us wrong, getting us into deep.
Written in the mind of man, song for Daniel Ellsberg by James Stein. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we remember Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who died on June 16th at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His actions helped take down President Nixon, end the war in Vietnam, and lead to a major victory for press freedom. Over the past 50 years, Ellsberg remained an anti-war and anti-nuclear activist who inspired a new generation of whistleblowers. We return now to our April interview, when I asked Dan Ellsberg about what a recent leak of Pentagon documents say about the war in Ukraine.
It's shown from the reaction to these leaks, the major leak being, once again, like the Pentagon Papers, that when a war appears to be stalemated, it may be stalemated from the inside just as well. That's what the Pentagon Papers showed, that there is no real prospect for progress and that killing people is on either side unjustified by any prospect of any humane result. Intelligence estimates have shown that a year from now, we will probably be in pretty much the same positions, a stalemate, and will not be willing to negotiate. What does that say about the people who are making our foreign policy? If that doesn't define a crisis, an emergency, what would? Well, yes, I suppose the prospect that we're about to lose within a month, and that's not what either is facing yet. I don't want to test how either side reacts if they're facing that. If the U.S. were to do what Biden is urged to do by many, which is to direct U.S. participation in the war, shooting Russians, as I say, for the first time since 1920, two years after the First World War ended, we were still shooting at Russians against Bolsheviks in 1920. Every Russian knows that. How many Americans know that? Any? So that they have that very much in their memory. When Biden is urged to send direct planes that Ukrainians can't yet operate, like the F-16, tanks that they cannot yet operate. The tendency to send Americans to operate those tanks and get them right away into business will be very strong along with that. I can only hope that Biden will be pressed by a large part of the public, pressed not to involve the U.S. directly in that war and to be pursuing negotiations, which it is currently absolutely eschewing, is rejecting the idea of negotiations. There's increasing information